Call this meeting to order. Ms. Coronado, would you take the roll, please?
Councilmember Eugene Connors is excused. Councilmember Joan Hanson?
Here.
Councilmember Shirley Dowdy?
Present.
Mayor Ronald Ertley?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Anna Klein?
Here.
Councilmember Douglas Dunn?
Here.
Councilmember Serena Sullivan?
Here.
City staff, Ashley Coronado, City Clerk, Jack Ernest, Fire Chief, Britt Hanson, City Attorney.
Thank you very much. Item number one, presentation on the Bigby Fire Department operations. First off, let me say that we're very honored to have a large contingent of the Bigby Fire Department here tonight. Thank you all very much for coming out. This work session was asked for by Councilperson Klein, so I will defer to her right now.
Thank you, Mayor. Good evening, everyone. Back in June, when the fire department and public safety was being discussed, it was apparent that this is an area that is never fully understood and that most of us take for granted, and that these services are just provided without knowing what it takes to maintain this level of service we as a community have come to appreciate and expect. I felt that an educational, informational work session would be very helpful so that we can learn of the fire department operations and all the services they provide, and to hear it directly from the firefighters themselves. Firefighting is dark and dangerous. It's not the glorious walk through the flames that Hollywood would expect you to believe. Fire departments exist to protect lives, property, and the environment. They could probably be called the Department of Environmental Intervention, but we would never dream of changing the name. But it does suggest what they really do. When there's disease, disaster, fire, injury, or accident threatens to impact negatively on another human, in any way, the fire department is called. Since the early days, more expectations and jobs were added to the list of fire department responsibilities, and mostly without adequate funding. The firefighters welcomed these new responsibilities, but once they explained that more equipment and more personnel were needed to achieve these goals, those who control the budget usually don't want to provide the funding. This isn't new. It's been going on for many years. Firefighters do not just fight fires. They are sent to medical calls daily. Some types of calls needed to respond to are difficulty breathing, choking, sick call, car accidents, flooded areas, structure fires, brush fires, trees falling, heart attack, seizure, welfare check, and hazmat calls. My dad even responded to a cat in a tree and a kid stuck in a cooking pot. So don't think all they do is fight fires. They see bad things and sometimes good, like delivering babies. It takes a special breed of person who is able to do this job successfully. And, I mean, it's no surprise that I'm very proud of these guys, and I appreciate daily what they do. And with that, I don't know who's taking over. Chief.
I will say we do have a couple people signed up to speak, but they will do after your presentation.
Okay. No, they can do it. Good evening, Mayor and Council. It gives me great pride and honor to be able to stand up here and represent these fine gentlemen from the Bisbee Fire Department in order to show you and explain to you just what they do. We hope that this meeting will be informative, educational, and fulfilling, because I know there's a lot of questions that people don't understand on what the actual work that the fire department does. I'm highly proud and honored that I can say that I've hired every one of these people on the fire department, and I feel that it was a good choice, and we've built and designed a A1 fire department in Bisbee. We can stand up to any department in the state of Arizona. We've been told that, and they work hard, and they work long hours, and they do an outstanding job, and I would put them up against anybody in Arizona. We come to you today with this is just an overview of what's going to be talked about, and then I'll present to you the next person that's going to give you the information. And at any time, I presume you can ask any questions or whatever along the way if you'd like, so you don't forget what you want to ask. But just an overview of what's going to be talked about. There's going to be an introduction by Captain Bernalite, and then we're going to have a brief history on the Bisbee Fire Department, which goes back many, many years, we all know. We're going to talk about fire department operations, which is includes a lot of stuff that the fire department does that people are not aware of. They're going to talk about the calls they've had in 2014 and give you an idea of the calls that the firefighters run. We could talk about the required training that they have to do in order to keep up on all the changes within the fire service and EMS. We're going to talk about fire response, EMS operations, which is about 85 to 90% of our call load. Community relations, which is important for the fire department because of the busy firefighters that provide that to the community. We're going to talk about fire inspections, which is important not only to the fire department but the community as a safety. We're going to talk about our vehicles, and then they're going to do some hands-on presentations to you for you tonight that I think you're going to be totally amazed at some of the stuff that the fire department does, especially our medical end of it. Though we do fight fires, and they do a very good job, but because they run 90% of our calls are medical, I think you're going to be pretty impressed by some of the stuff that they do. So feel free to ask any questions. I'm glad that this was able to come true. Too bad there's not more public here, but you know, it's being broadcasted, and I think that you'll be very impressed by what you're going to hear tonight. So without further ado, Captain Myrtle, I would like to continue. Thank you.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. I'm Captain Bernalite, and I've proudly been a member of the Bisbee Fire Department for 16 years. We're looking forward to this work session as an opportunity to help Mayor and Council and the general public to better understand the full and diverse range of the services afforded our community by the Bisbee Fire Department. Although some of these services and duties may be obvious, some are not. But even those that are require more training and planning and education than most people think. More often than one may think also, the fire department is unjustly and at times irresponsibly criticized in public and privately by misinformed and uninformed individuals or groups. If allowed to go unchecked, these negative comments, ideas, or accusations can create not only a negative atmosphere, but doubt or mistrust in the services we try hard to provide. We know and understand the extreme financial burden that public safety retirement puts on the budget. However, our department helps offset some of that burden by consistently bringing in close to $1 million a year in revenue from our ambulance services and have presented ideas that could significantly increase this amount. Therefore, we embrace this opportunity to present to you tonight a full and comprehensive demonstration of the services the Bisbee Fire Department provides. Hopefully you'll learn a lot. Hopefully you'll enjoy it. Please feel free to, like Chief said, ask questions at any time during or after the presentation. And we'll get right to it. So this will be Lieutenant Perez giving us a history of the
business. We have a question from Councilperson Klein.
Captain Bernalite, you mentioned criticism and, you know, that. Do you have examples? Will you be talking about these examples later on, or would you wish to address them now?
Actually, we didn't really specifically plan to talk about them unless asked, and since you did, just off the top, real quickly, we're going to emphasize the importance of inter-facility transfers to our department and how that helps the income and revenue and our community. Also, some of the things brought into question about fire response and times on fires, and then members of the public getting up and making comments about our ambulance that was put out to bid and pretty much had funding for, and then it was tabled due to, we think, some inaccurate information at the time. And as time's gone on, we have been awarded a grant that ambulance will be being purchased. And it did put a severe strain on our operation, as well as putting some of the public at risk. So we are happy that that will be happening. And that we can go into more detail at another time, but we'd like to get the presentation.
Okay, thank you.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. I'm Lieutenant Mark Perez. I'm a second-generation firefighter. And my father retired from here in 1988. And I'm going to be presenting tonight is just a brief history. We're going to touch on some of the highlights of the department. And to go in depth on every single piece of information about our department, we don't have enough time for that. that would take a long time. We're going to start out in the 1800s. There were three major fires that destroyed most of Main Street, 1885, 1887, and 1888. And the main reason why Bisbee was actually rebuilt so quick was because the fire got stopped pretty much by the big drainage ditch right there. And the firefighting equipment in these days was limited to buckets and barrels of water. One method of fighting fire was placing barrels of water on rooftops. Then if a fire starts, they would shoot holes in the barrel with pistols to release the water. This novel form of firefighting was never very effective. We jump forward to October 1st of 1894. That was when the first volunteer fire department was formed. And the headquarters for this for the department was a shack on Main Street, about where the Atalanta bookstore used to be. In 1898, a brick building was built right about where 3 and 5 Main Street stands now, and the first volunteer fire department had to use manually pulled hose carts. In 1903, a fire ordinance was actually adopted in the city of Bisbee. The ordinance outlined a fire district, which is now mostly Old Bisbee, and set new building regulations, such as new buildings must be constructed of brick, adobe, or stone, and frame buildings must be veneered in either plastic, stone, or brick. The fire of 1907. In 1907, a gas stove in the Colorado boarding house at the foot of Chihuahua Hill exploded. The volunteer fire department could not control the fire. The fire department was hampered by a shortness of hose and low water pressure. The fire was finally stopped by Bisbee miners who came to the surface after the first alarm. They rigged dynamite inside houses north of the Pythian Castle and detonated them. This action actually created a fire break which saved the rest of the hill as well as the town. In April of 1908, City of Bisbee Fire Department was created. An ordinance was passed by the City Council to create and maintain a full-time fire department. It also moved the fire station to Knuckle Road and replaced the manually pulled hose carts with horses and wagons, and named C.M. Henkel as the first fire chief of the Bisbee Fire Department. The fire of 1908 was one of the worst fires of all time to hit Main Street. On October 14th, 1908, when a gas stove exploded in the Grand Hotel, if fire hose would have been available, the fire would have been extinguished within minutes, but there wasn't one. The fire spread rapidly up and down and around Main Street and Clausen Hill before once again dynamite was used on buildings near Castle Rock. Damages were $750,000, and if you could convert that into today's dollars from 1908, that would be a significant amount. And to add to that, one of the little pieces of paper that you have up there that looks like this is actually a copy of the insurance claims. I thought that was really neat that the Mining Museum had this, so I just added it to the presentation. The Globe Review reported the light of Bisbee's burning was seen from Pinnell Peak, which is 140 miles from Bisbee by air. Any questions so far? In 1908, tragedy actually hit the Bisbee Fire Department. July 1st, 1909 brought the only line of duty death of a firefighter in Bisbee Fire Department history. On June 29th, 1909, a boxcar full of hydrochloric acid containers caught fire. After the flames were extinguished, George Moores was moving containers when one flared up in his face. Moores inhaled the toxic fumes. He was unaffected at the time until later that night when he started to cough. 2 days later, George Moores passed away from the exposure. In 1914, Station 2, which we call Station 82 now, was built. That's the station at 645 Tombstone Canyon, which we still use today. In 1917, under Chief B.W. Norton, the city of Bisbee received an American LaFrance motorized fire truck. Two more were added in the next 2 years. In 1938, the PD Mercantile store fire. September 1938, the PD Mercantile store burst into flames. The fire was fast and thorough in burning down the PD building. Bisbee, Warren, and Lowell fire departments were called to the scene. Between being highly trained, having plenty of fire hose and a good water supply, the firemen saved the surrounding buildings, including the PD warehouse, the Bank of Bisbee, which is now the Western Bank, and the dispensary. 1940 and 41, Ford Motor Company specially designed two wedge-shaped fire trucks for Old Bisbee. These two trucks are the only two trucks of their kind, as this design was never produced again. And we still have the 1941, which would be the one on the left-hand side up there. Late 1957, early 1958, Bisbee incorporated the suburbs of Lowell, Warren, and San Jose. When that happened, the Bisbee Fire Department grew to five fire stations. The one on Knockle Road, which was the old City Hall, 645 Tombstone Canyon, built in 1914. The one at the traffic circle where the police department is today was actually the Lowell Fire Station. 404 Bisbee Road, where Public Works was before they moved over here, and the Highway 92 and Knockle Highway interchanges.
A comment or sort of a question.
Sure.
The 1908 fire, that is when the Bisbee government decided we needed essentially a full-time fire department,
and
not volunteer.
They actually approved the full-time fire department a few months before the fire.
Okay.
They were just still getting everything together when that fire broke out.
So those people at that time realized the importance of having a full-time fire department.
Yes, sir, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you.
In the 1970s, the Bisbee Fire Department was reduced to three stations. With the closing of the mines and the population decreasing, Bisbee Fire Department closed a station on Knockle Road and at the traffic circle. In 1975, Bisbee Fire Department took over EMS services from Cochise County. That means that the county that used to run the ambulance, they actually let the city take that over. And in 1978, Leslie Wheat became the actual first professional female firefighter in the state of Arizona. And I don't remember how many years she worked, Chief.
She worked here just about 2 years.
Just about 2 years? Okay. Okay. In 1980, county took back the EMS services, and their station was actually where the police station is today. In 1990, with the county budgets being what they were, they said it was okay for Bisbee Fire to take over EMS services, and we still have it to this day. In the late 1990s, there were actually, or mid to late 1990s, there were actually two serial arsonists that actually struck Old Bisbee. And Captain Castillo, Lieutenant Ray, and Captain Bernalite came on right at the tail end of that. And what the city did to that was they actually had extra police officers patrolling. And the firefighters actually were cruising the streets in Old Bisbee in the fire trucks just in case the fires were coming so fast they would have an even quicker response. The city council even offered a $5,000 reward to help capture who was doing it.
Could I ask about how many fires were set? Do you have a number on that about? Approximately, you don't have to give a precise number.
You know, there was approximately 5 to 4 to 5 structure fires were actually.
Yeah.
Captain Castillo actually has a really good book about it, and if you show up to the 101 on the 17th, he'd be more than happy to go through every single one of them with you. In 1998, Station 1, which is the station we operate out of now, was built on Highway 92, which joined the Warren and the Don Louis fire stations. And for the 2000s, we're just going to touch on a few of the major fires that have happened. We're not going to hit all of them because there was more than this. but these are just some that stick out in a lot of people's minds. July 4, 2003, the Garden Avenue fire started in a storage warehouse. The crews were on scene for approximately 16 hours, and in that time, no exposures were lost. And that warehouse actually butted up about maybe, 5 to 10 feet away from the closest structure. 2006, the Hill Street fire. Gentleman had a propane heater going on in his house. Heater got knocked over. He actually sustained a few injuries. That fire was constructed in an old building, and we didn't lose any exposures on that either. 2007, 741B Tombstone Canyon. Fully involved house fire. The lady who owned it was actually remodeling it at the time. Not only did we have to deal with the fire, but just getting to it, there was pallets of wood and sheetrock, everything stacked up outside it. It was a little bit of a maze. Our closest exposure on that one, 10 feet away, suffered no damage. The 30 Moon fire burned approximately 800 to 1,000 acres. No structures were lost, no major injuries. The 2009 Mule Pass fire. The fire started heading towards West Boulevard, Compton, and Highland Park, and the crews that were on scene that day actually got up and caught that. The fire ran up the hill, but once again, no structures lost, no major injuries. I think one of the wildland guys had a sprained ankle. 2014, Thanksgiving Day fire. And one of the other handouts that you have in front of you right here, where it says Thanksgiving on the bottom, we have received a little bit of criticism on this. Some people have said that it took us over 20 minutes to get there. If you look at some of the highlighted parts, you'll see S81, or SP81. That was Captain Brandon Davey running radio traffic for Engine 82. Excuse me. If you look at the timestamps on these are timestamped by Spillman on an atomic clock. You can't just go in there and change the times around and have a printout on it. It took them about 2 minutes to get on scene, where we've been criticized, people saying that it's taken us 20 minutes. So that, Councilmember Klein, when you asked about some of the criticism, we've heard that from several people, that it took us 20 minutes. Just don't lie.
Thank you.
On that fire, I think that's the one down in the corner right there. Fully involved structure, it blew out through the roof, and the fire was so intense that the only damage to the surrounding structures was from radiant heat. And at the same time, Captain Davey, you said the floor collapsed into the basement, correct? Yeah, because I personally wasn't there on that fire. But if you have any questions for that, Captain Davey would be happy to answer them. He was the first man on scene, and just going over the after-action report, these guys did a fantastic job there.
Let me ask a question, because if the quick response wasn't made, was it highly likely that a lot of other structures could have gone down?
Pretty much the whole block.
Okay.
Would have probably, whichever way the prevailing winds were that day, like I said, I wasn't there, the fire would have just got with the wind, ran up the hill, and went straight across through that whole block.
So the most important thing in a fire is to get there as quickly as you possibly
can.
Yes, sir.
Councilmember
Klein?
Since Lieutenant Perez wasn't on that actual fire, this question is for Captain Davey. It's my understanding that the location of the fire, and we can kind of see, but it was inaccessible. You weren't able to drive engines or anything up to the structure, correct?
No, ma'am. We were unable to drive the actual engine to the structure. We had to actually stretch hose in several different directions and try to pin it in. We were able to bring a truck from the top eventually and drop hose line from the top. But initially, we had come up from the front and started making an attack. There was one structure directly above it, which is a two-story structure, and it's a wood shingle. When I got on scene, it looked like that structure was just about ready to go. We were able to get a 2.5 round sight, which is a big diameter hose gun, and then some 1.5 from the other side, pull that house down, and also start the initial fire attack. There was also reports of somebody stuck in the structure at that time, too, when we were came on scene. She was able to extricate herself, but she had some burns.
And where it was located, how close were the other homes?
Actually, all four sides were surrounded by... Oh, correction. All three sides were surrounded by structures that were relatively close. The ones above uphill, obviously, were more dangerous. I'm having a hard time thinking about actual feet, but everything was real close, which is pretty typical for old baby.
And it didn't give you much room to maneuver and...
That's always something that we... a problem that we bump into kind of problem. Old baby, any room, getting vehicles in there, and just operational, staying away from the actual structure, like burning a safe distance.
Thank you.
Just a quick comment. I know the Bisbee Fire Department responded quickly and did a great job on that. In the audience tonight is somebody that I think a retired firefighter. I think he assisted you guys. Is that correct, Mr. Ken Budge?
She says yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Like I said, I wasn't there, so that's why I'm turning and looking. What I forgot to explain is how to read this on Spillman. Instead of going from top to bottom, you actually go from the bottom to the top. Hope I didn't cause any confusion with that. And the last one we're going to touch on was the Boris fire that we just had this past summer. And due to the extensive amount of contents, the fire actually took longer than normal to extinguish. And once again, printed out the whole Spillman, and you can see our actual response times on that. And the hard part about Spillman right here is usually whenever you get a structure fire going, you're going to have anywhere from 5 to 10 people talking on the radio at the same time, and there's only one dispatcher. And Sergeant Long and the Bisbee Police Department over there, they do an outstanding job getting there on scene. They help us pull hose to hook up to the hydrants. And between their radio traffic, our radio traffic, this is just within the first few minutes of a fire, not including all the radio traffic that goes on there. So that's it for me on this one. So hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Perez.
Good evening, Mayor, Council. I'm Captain George Castillo. I've been a sea ship. I'm on sea shift. I've been a captain for the department for probably about 9 years. I've been with the department this December will be 25 years. I'm going to take you guys through our operations and how we operate, and I'm also going to get into our type of calls and the number of calls we run a year. We, the members of the Bisbee Fire Department, dedicate our efforts to provide for the safety and welfare of the public through preservation, life, property, and the environment. To provide 24 hours response to all type of hazards and emergency situations, to include 24 hours of ACLS response, as well as interfacility patient transports from one hospital to another. This service is provided to all the citizens of Bisbee and the residents living within our state licensed CON. The fire department is also responsible for enforcement of the Uniform Fire Code and the inspection of all businesses and public access areas. The fire department is charged with investigating for a cause of the origin of any and all fires within its jurisdiction. Public education and also is also provided through many different avenues, such as schools and civil organizations, and is responsible for fire prevention, education, and training within the city. A pre-hospital 911 emergency response is one of the most essential public safety functions provided by the fire service in support of the community health, security, and the prosperity. Fire service-based emergency medical services, EMS systems, are strategically positioned to deliver time, critical responses, and effective patient care. Fire service-based EMS provides this pivotal public safety service while emphasizing the responder safety, competent and compassionate workers, and cost-effective operation. It is critical that citizens and local government understand the importance of having emergency medical services provided throughout the fire service. Due to the training and expertise and equipment of the fire service-based EMS responders, we are capable of simultaneously securing a scene, mitigation of a hazard, and triaging, extricating, and treating and decontaminating if necessary, and transporting the patients who have been injured to an appropriate medical facility. Time efficiently is the key component of the best designed EMS system. There is no service more compatible of rapid multi-phase response than the fire-based EMS system, as opposed to a private ambulance or a volunteer. The Bisbee Fire Department has been providing paramedic level EMS services since the early 1990s. The Bisbee Fire provides the most advanced medical care to our city and surrounding areas, which cover over 400 square miles. Our firefighter EMTs and our firefighter paramedics are some of the most highly educated and trained in the state. At our current staffing levels, the Bisbee Fire Department will continue to provide the highest quality of services possible while enhancing the general fund revenues. Do I have any questions? Not so far. Okay, we're going to get into our everyday operations, and this is every day when we come to work. Our shift starts at 0700 in the morning. We come to duty. We're relieved. When we're leaving our shift, the shift captain briefs the oncoming captain of things that need to be done, as if vehicles need to be taken to the garage for service, if an inspection needs to be done, if there's a public event, or they can discuss if there was a major call or a fire. They tell us about whatever happened if we weren't there and what needs to be done to clean up or get back in service, hose or whatever. We also do briefing between the neighboring fire department, which is Palominas Fire, who we are in a interagency agreement with now. Copper Queen Hospital, we call them to let them know what is going on, if there's any transfers pending, so we can kind of prepare for the day so we can get our staff able to take these transports. Because I will go into that, there has been a significant increase in transport since the hospital closed in Douglas, which is putting a real strain on our guys. And we also talk with Arizona Ambulance. Even though they are a private company, they're there to utilize if we need their help. Then we get into performing our daily assignments. We check our vehicles. We check our oil every day. We make sure our vehicles are full of fuel. We do tire pressure checks every day. We make sure all our medical equipment is up to standard, our O2 is filled up, air packs topped off. We want to be ready to go in case there is an emergency. So we've got to make sure everything's done, make sure our gear is ready to go. And after that's all done, we can wash vehicles and everything like that. And then we get into if there's any type of training that needs to be done that day, any class or whatever, then we do that. And, you know, we're there for 24 hours, so we're pretty much busy throughout the day. Usually after 5 o'clock is kind of our downtime. That's what most people think, it's downtime. That's what we would hope it'd be downtime, but it seems like when that sun goes down, that's our busiest time. At night is when we're really busy. When most people are sleeping, we're out running calls. I'm going to kind of go over some calls. These are for calls of the calendar year of 2014. I'm going to focus first on the EMS calls. EMS 911 transports. We transported, this is when we were called for a call, and we actually transport that patient to a hospital. We did 800 of those in 2014, but you can kind of, that number will, or actually is higher than that, but it's just put in a different category. If you look there, it says MVA, which we had 48 motor vehicle accidents. out of them motor vehicle accidents, some might not have been transported. Some were also transported. Some probably were fatalities and not even transported. But for the computer system that we have to keep track of the calls we run a year, we have that in the motor vehicle accident department. But there is transport involved with a motor vehicle accident. Same thing with EMS good intent. This is when we are called 911 for emergency call, and it turns out that they're not being transported by an ambulance. They can get calls for something, and then they can refuse transport. Or they want to go to the hospital, but they don't want to pay an ambulance, so they go POV. We did 289 of those. These are also, again, can be associated with the MVAs, where a minor MVA, you check them, they don't want to be transported. Interfacility transports. Bisbee Fire did 411 in 2014. Arizona Ambulance did 295 of those transports. A lot of times where the Arizona Ambulance does the transports is when we are already out on a transport. Sometimes we get back-to-back transfers. We'll get one 5 minutes later, get toned out for another. Sometimes another 5 minutes later, toned out for another. If we have the resources, we can sometimes get two of them. Now that Palominas Fire helped us, we have utilized their medics as well. But sometimes we've had to give them to Arizona Ambulance for that reason of either mechanical failure of our vehicles or we don't have enough staffing or we're already out on transfers. Again, motor vehicle accidents, 40-hour, we want that. Mutual aid, we did 11 of those. That's where we've assisted another agency in helping them. It can be another fire department. It could be the hospital. Sometimes we've been called to the hospital to help them with a patient in the ER. We've helped the police on something. They may need a ladder to get up on a building to check something if there was a burglary or something. So that's mutual aid. Patient transfers home, we did 11. It's when we transport a patient from the hospital to their home, and the reason why is there's no other way for that patient to get home. It's required an ambulance because they need to be, they're non-ambulatory, can walk or anything like that. It needs an ambulance to get home.
I have a question.
Yes,
on the 800 transports, the 911 transports, were those local to the hospitals in Bisbee, or did you have to go into Sierra Vista?
I'm going to say a good, probably 90% of them were sent to Bisbee. Sometimes patients request or depending on the critical of the patient. I mean, you could be out there, we covered to the river.
Right.
So we could be out there on the river on Highway 90 and have a patient there. Now that hospital, Canyon Vista, is closer. Most likely we were going to go to the closest facility. But I'm going to say about 90% of these were transported through Cochise.
But it's within Cochise. You're not going to Tucson.
No, only on
the facility. Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
Councilman McClain.
Since we're kind of stopped for questions here. You talked about the increase in interfacility transfers since the Douglas Hospital closed. Do we know how much of an increase do we have?
Yeah, as soon as I get through this, there's a little section I want to show you an increase of what we've been going through within the last couple of months.
Okay, and then when you brought up the mutual aid and you brought up the police department, I think it's interesting to note that when they had the drug tunnel in NACO, that they actually borrowed some of our air packs to go into the tunnel.
I believe it was, I'm not sure if they borrowed our air packs, I think it was, yeah, and I know that I went up there, I took the engine down there with a ladder. They needed a ladder to get up on the roof of the house up there to check for evidence of hidden contraband or whatever up there.
Yeah, I just find that interesting because it's, you wouldn't think of fire service doing these types of calls, hazmat calls or whatnot. Thank you.
You're welcome. Now we're getting to fires. In 2014, we responded to 11 brush fires. That's a good number. 11 is not a lot, and that's a good thing because we all know Old Bisbee up in the mountain area. If the conditions are right, the winds are right, we've had several brush fires up in that area, and we've had quick response. and good training that we have prevented. We didn't have any structure loss on any big major brush fire we've had up there. So 11's good. Like I said, brush fires in Old Bisbee are bad. We, as much as firemen like fires, we don't like to see brush fires in Old Bisbee. That's one thing. That's a pretty good number, 11 for the whole city of Bisbee in a year. Structure fires, we responded to 8 of them. Vehicle fires was 6. Down line is usually we're called for a power line that's down. Or a lot of times we call for a power line, it turns out just to be a telephone line. Dumpster fires responded to 4. GI is fire good intent. This is when we are dispatched to either smoke showing in the area, somebody thinks there's a fire, we respond, it turns out to be a false alarm. Hazardous condition, we responded to 25 of those. This is pretty much hazards that people have reported. It could be simple vehicle, gas leaking from a vehicle to oil spill, or to just somebody's yard that somebody's complained about that's hazardous condition. Fire other is a fire that's not categorized in any of those. It's just a fire per se is smoke coming from a barrel or something. You know, it's just considered a fire.
Does your department clean up, let's say, a meth house gets busted, for example? Does your department do that?
We'd probably respond and stand by, but as it comes to that, you need a certified hazardous material team. Well, all of us are trained in hazmat, but we're not trained into hazardous material technician. I believe it's a pretty extent course. We don't have, when you get into hazmat, you're talking some big money for these suits and mm-hmm. all that stuff. We kind of leave that to the experts, but we will respond and kind of secure the scene, but we will not make entry into that.
Thank you.
Unless maybe there's a life situation where we have to rescue somebody. We also, not only during fire responses and ambulance responses, we also do non-emergency responses as well. These are in our everyday shifts. B calls, we responded to 12 of those. These usually people are calling, they see a big ball of bees in a tree. They call us to eradicate them. Most of the time when they're up like that, they are very safe. It's usually when they have a hive established, that's when they're aggressive. And usually if that's the case, we call an exterminator to get rid of them. Inspections, we did 80, and I know Firefighter Hickman is going to elaborate more on some of the inspections when he comes up here. CPR, we taught 10 classes last year. We usually teach a class every month, depending on, you know, if people sign up. You know, we have a regular heart saver class and a healthcare provider class and a first aid class every 3 months that we provide at our fire station. Helo support, we did 1. That's when we have to go down to Greenway School and set up a LZ for another helicopter coming in. That's when usually either there's a bad accident and we're transporting to the hospital and they have 2 helicopters, or sometimes there's 2 critical patients at the hospital that need air transport. One's there, another one's coming in, we need a place to land it. They call us, we set up an LZ at the school. Hose detail, we did 5 of those. This is when we service our hose, we test them, check them, make sure everything's good. Manpower assist, 14. What we do for that is when we're out on a call and the crew needs help, they will call us for assistance if they need extra equipment in the house or help carrying somebody down the stairs in Old Bisbee. Special ops, 46. Special ops are where we're called to the schools, football games, per se, track meets, any type of Boy Scouts have something, Boys and Girls Clubs, where we set up fire preventions. Those are all considered special ops. Public assist, 130. It's when we are called to help the citizens that live here, assisting them to home from the hospital. They went to the hospital, they're elderly, can't get up the steps in Old Bisbee. They call us out, we put them in our special chair, we take them up and down the steps. Training, we logged in 81 training days in 2014. And welfare checks, 5 were called out to check on the welfare of somebody. Okay, calls to date. These are from calendar here now, January 1st, 2015, and this was till yesterday. We had it set on the 7th. As of now, we have done 478 EMS transports. The good intent calls, we've already responded to 202. Interfacility transports, we've already done 342. Arizona Ambulance has done 261. The high number, again, for Arizona Ambulance, 261, is we were down at least over a month with no ambulance to transport, just our main ambulance to run 911. Just recently, we had a Douglas ambulance, a Fry Fire ambulance, and one of the ambulances we share with Palominas in our bay. We were using those ambulances because all of ours were down. We were still able to, with the help of these neighboring fire departments, we were still able to get back into the transfer business and still provide 911 for the citizens. 38 MVAs so far. Structure fires this year, we've had 4. Brush fires, 10. And interfacility transfers there on the right, that's the kind of what I was getting to, Anna, what you wanted to talk about. From April 1st to July 1st, we did 85 transfers. July 1st is around, that's the time I'm guessing the hospitals in Douglas are shutting down. And you can see from July 1st till yesterday, we've already, our fire department has already did 163 transfers. The hospital is toning out at least 6, 7, sometimes 10 transfers a day. We try to do as many as we can, and I do want to say kudos to, we have 3 medics in our department that would be Captain Bernalik, Captain Ray, and Captain Davey, or Lieutenant Ray, sorry. Captain, you just look so good in that suit. These guys have really stepped up and worked some hours to take care of these patients that needed to go to Tucson, so there wasn't any delay in waiting for other agencies. They've stepped up. There's been a lot, you know, I'm sure in the books there's been a lot of overtime, but, you know, these guys really worked hard, and we got 2 guys that just graduated from the paramedic school. It's a firefighter Villasenor and firefighter Nicholas Rivera. They're our new medics. They are certified now. They are going to be going through the training, and so they're going to be turned loose. So now we got 2 extra medics now that we can actually step up to work a little bit and give some of our medics a little bit of rest. That's pretty much all I got. If you guys got any questions.
Any questions from the council? Thank you, Mr. Castillo.
You're welcome.
Before the next presentation, I do want to make note that the aide to Congresswoman Martha McSally came in. Sarah Pacheco, she's back in the corner. Thanks for coming.
Hello again, Mayor and Council. I'm going to briefly go over part of the training that we do with the Bisbee Fire Department. Our monthly training, Bisbee Fire Department conducts training in accordance with NFPA, that's National Fire Protection Agency, 1500. Training is done at a minimum of 16 hours per month per firefighter. Training is logged in the daily log and paper training forms. Each firefighter has a folder with all of their training forms and certificates. Examples of the training we do are tagging the hydrants to flow water to the trucks, pulling and deploying of the pre-connected hose loads, rescue drills, etc. We also log hundreds of hours each year in driver area training. This aids in locating hydrants, possible placement of fire engines, and address recognition, especially in Old Bisbee where C or D addresses would be accessed easier from a different street. Getting into NFPA, there are 471 NFPA standards. And since I got your attention, we'll go over all of them. Just kidding. The most relevant to us are NFPA 1001, which is a professional firefighter qualifications. It's Fire 1 and 2, is a full year of schooling with 18 college credits, and these are the books
that we go through for Fire 1 and 2. Anybody want to take a look at them? Free to do it. Next one is NFPA 1002 standard, Fire Apparatus Driver Operator, which is a full semester of school. And once again, if anybody wants to look through them, more than welcome to. Next one is our Fire Inspector, NFPA 1031. The accelerated course is 40 hours, which means you need to read this book before you show up to the class. A normal course is 6 weeks. The Fire Service Instructor course is the exact same size and the same thing. The accelerated course is a 40-hour class, and the normal course is a 6-week course. NFPA 1051 is our wildland firefighter qualifications. That's a 40-hour class, and these are just two of the books. And we also do an 8-hour recert every year. One of the other things that every firefighter has to do here is from FEMA and NIMS. NIMS is the National Incident Management Safety Training. Every employee does ICS 100, which is Introduction to NIMS, ICS 200, Single Resource and Initial Action Incidents, and ICS 700 for NIMS. Additionally, the officers have to take an ICS 300 class, which is intermediate ICS for expanding incidents, and all of the first one, the 100, 200, and 700 are all online. The ICS 300 is a 3-day class, and the ICS 400, which that's this book right here, is for advanced ICS for command and general staff stressing unified command. Also, every single person here who goes through Fire 1 and 2 hazmat is a hazmat first responder operations. That is part of your Firefighter 1 and 2 class, and you end up going through this book right here in about 30 hours. Any questions?
Nope.
I'll show you this.
Councilperson Dowdy.
Do you, all of you speak Spanish?
No,
because
ma'am.
No,
ma'am.
Don't you pick up a lot of...
We can pick up a lot of the medical talk that we use for that, but as far as just conversation Spanish, not all of us can do it. And
just curious.
I'm not very good at it either. Okay, from here we're going to go straight into fire train to the fires that we respond to. Kevin? Kevin's going to be our little demonstration person today. You got anything there? Okay, hold on. Okay, our get in the front. For structure fires, the usual call starts with the alarm from dispatch. Dispatch will be saying fire assignment, followed by the address. That time, we'll come from wherever we're at and get into our gear. Go ahead. While Trevor's getting his gear on right there, just a little note, our turnout gear weighs, on the average, depending on what you have in your pockets, 30 pounds. So that's 30 extra pounds of equipment that you're going to have on you. That's usually how we're dressed whenever we're responding to the fire, driving the trucks. Or if he's driving an ambulance, that's what he looks like. When we respond, once we get there, en route to the fire, we're actually doing our scene size up from a distance. We're trying to read the smoke. You still got time to get ready because you're not there yet. Okay, well, like I said, our scene size up starts whenever we can actually see the first plume of smoke. We'll read the smoke. Is it light? Is it dark? Is it getting pressed out? Is it coming up vertically? Is it blowing across? All that stuff makes a big difference because then it lets us know if the fire's going to have a chance to spread on us rapidly or not. Okay. Once we get on scene, one of the first things we'll do, we'll call dispatch, give them the scene size up. We pull up to the building. We're looking at the building, and we have little sectors. If here's the building, we have Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta. We'll call it in to let them know if we see smoke or flames coming out of which section of the house. While the IC, which is the incident commander, is doing that, he's also asking, is there any occupants left in the structure? Because that determines on, since we only have such small crews, the most we usually get on a fire at one time is 4 people. That's the initial attack on that. In Old Bisbee, you have 2 people on that truck getting up there. When the commander's giving his scene size up and finding out if there's any occupants left there, the crew will be donning their air packs. Okay, these air packs that we have, the ISI Vikings, they're actually a lot lighter than the old ones, and these ones still weigh in at 20 pounds. Another part of our scene size up is the type of building that we're going to be dealing with. In the fire service, we have what we consider 5 different types of building construction. A type one building would be fire resistant. It's made of concrete and metal. The primary hazard is everything inside. A good example of that is a parking garage. And that's what Trevor's going to look like when he gets ready to go fight the fire. And quite frankly, that stuff gets really, really hot. So we're going to let him go ahead and take that off right now. If anybody's willing to come on up and put the air pack on, I'm sure he'll let you.
Councilmember Klein, do you have a comment?
Question, Lieutenant. Once they get their air packs on, and I know, you know, with 9/11 coming up, when we were watching a lot of the footage, we heard so much of the beeping on the air packs signaling that firefighter was
Hold
not moving. How much time has to lapse before it kicks in?
The standard is usually about 45 seconds to a minute of somebody not moving. Is it still on? Turn it on and just go ahead and set it down. Yeah, go ahead and set it down. So you don't have to be totally stationary. Yeah, it'll start going off in about a minute. Or if you're in trouble, there's a little button on top. You can actually reach up and hit it, and it'll start going off right there. Because when you're actually in a real working structure fire, you can't see anything. The smoke is thick, and everything you do, you're on your hands and knees, and you're feeling your way around. That's just the let it go. That's the warning, your movement warning to let you know, hey, it's getting ready to go off. And that's what that sounds like. Okay. Good job. The other types of building construction. Oh, Mayor, you have a question?
No, I was just going to let the audience know that was a demonstration here at the council. The police are outside your house. Councilmember Sullivan.
So when the guys have all their gear on like that, do they have access to their walkie-talkies or anything? Can they still communicate somehow?
Oh, get your mask again and hook that up. I'm sorry. Some things I'm just so, I take it for granted. I'm used to it. With those masks that we have right there, they have LED lights inside to indicate how much air you have. And there's also a microphone in there. Louder. Right there on the coat pocket, that's where your radio is. You can key that. Your microphone's going to be right there. You can transmit. It's really hard to hear. In an actual fire, it's loud. It's really, really loud. And we can't wear earplugs in there because there's a chance if it's too hot, the earplugs will melt into your ear. Okay, any other questions so far?
How much does one weigh?
Councilmember Dowdy, you can ask Mr. Perez.
How much does all that gear weigh when they have it on?
Combined total between the air pack and the turnouts, and like I said, some turnouts guys carry more gear than others. Trevor has just the basic minimum that he carries, and that weighs 30 pounds. The air pack weighs 20 pounds, so you're talking 50 pounds of gear before you pick up any of the hose. Yes, the cost of these air packs right here, these ones are actually an older set. Each air pack is $1,500, and the turnouts that Trevor has right there, the GX7s, those ones right there, total for the hat, for the helmet, the gloves, your hood, that right there is $2,300.
Mayor, question?
Councilmember Klein.
45 for the air packs, including the mask. Sorry, I lowballed it.
What is it, Lieutenant?
Chief said they're $4,500 apiece.
$4,500. Question, are all of our air packs up to code?
Yes. We just had them tested in July.
Okay, thank you.
And they also test our masks, too, to make sure they're functioning properly every single time they come down.
Okay, thank you.
Back to the fires. We started on the different types of buildings we consider. Well, the fire service has the different types of building construction. Type 1 would be like a parking garage. Type 2, a good example of that, are commercial buildings where the sides are metal or concrete and the roofs are combustible material. Type 3, they consider ordinary construction, which the exterior walls are limited combustible or non-combustible, and the interior walls are wood with wood and tar paper roofs. Good example of that, brick houses. Type 4 is heavy timber. Exterior, interior walls and associated structural members, non-combustible or limited combustible materials, and the interior structures are the great big beams and arches made of solid or laminated wood. Example of that is rarely used today other than churches. And the type 5 is ordinary construction, which are wood frame houses. On our initial attack, if there's no rescue involved, we start deploying our hoses. Offensive attack, if you're ever scanning and you hear that we're going offensive on it, which means we're entering the structure to put the fire out at the seat. Defensive means the fire is already too big. We basically have to contain it to the one house, and we're going to save every single house around it because that one's already too far gone. And just to give you a little background on our hoses, 150-foot length of that hose that's sitting down there, it's 1 3/4. Each one weighs 20 pounds uncharged. That means no water in it. Our shortest pre-connect, which is pre-connect number 1, are 3 lengths, adding up to 150 feet, weighing 60 pounds. So think about Old Bisbee, 50 pounds on your back, plus you're dragging another 60 going up the hill. Our Pre-Connect 2 is four lengths, which is 200 feet long, weighing 80 pounds uncharged. The bigger one that Captain Davey mentioned earlier, a 2.5 length of hose, each one of those weighs between 35 and 40 pounds depending on the year it was made. And we do have hose that's still good, that is in service from 1977. When we use a thing called a horizontal standpipe, that'll be 2 to 4 lengths of the 2.5 inch hose, weighing anywhere from 70 to 140 pounds. And we use that mainly in Old Bisbee, where, like I said before, we couldn't really access the house. You would have to lay your horizontal standpipe. Did somebody pick that up? Anybody? That down there is what we call a high-rise pack. That's got 100 feet of hose on it, and the red thing you see dangling around there, that's a gated Y. We'll hook that up to a 2.5, and we have 100 feet of hose that we can use to fight the fire. We carry two of those preloaded just like that. One's on rescue, one's on Engine 82. Once the initial attack's starting, and the first engine that's in, we call that our attack engine. The second new engine in will be searching for a water supply. Water supplies are hydrants. And each one of our structure engines carries 100-foot lengths of 4-inch LDH, or large diameter hose, and each one of those weighs 90 pounds per 100 foot. And that's an example of LDH there, but that looks like one of the smaller ones. Was that 25 or a 50? It's the 50? Okay. Yeah, that's just a 50-foot length. So once we get close to the truck, we don't want to actually take another whole 100-footer off. We'll disconnect it and use one of the smaller lines to tag it right into the truck. And the way this is accomplished, usually a firefighter from the second engine pulls a section off of the hose off of the bed, they'll wrap it around the hydrant, and instruct the driver to drive to the fire. Once he gets there and the hose is attached to the attack engine, the hydrant is open. And just because you see a fire hydrant next to your house, it doesn't mean there's a lot of water coming out of it. There are four different types of hydrants. If you have red on the caps and on the top of it, that hydrant flows 0 to 499 gallons per minute. You have an orange hydrant, it's 500 to 999. A green hydrant will produce 1,000 to 1,499 GPMs, and a light blue, which we haven't color-coded those here, but we probably should in the downtown district because all that's on gravity, and those will flow anywhere from 1,500 to infinity on your gallons. So prime example, you live up by Wood Canyon, there's three hydrants on that street, and they're all red. So you're not getting too much water out of them. During the structure fire, the IC has to be aware of utilities and other hazards. The power company, power, gas, and water need to be secured, so when the crews are inside fighting the fire, nothing will get electrocuted, and if the gas isn't secured on it, there'll be enough heat left over in the building once you knock the fire down and back out that the gas will actually reignite. And there's almost always a hidden hazard found inside a structure, which are usually unknown to us until we get inside. Those could include basements, oxygen tanks, household chemicals, and we live in Arizona. A lot of people have guns, ammunition in the house. People also, for some reason here, will store propane tanks in their house, and they'll have kerosene heaters. We are fortunate to where we can call on some additional resources if the fire is too big. And those resources could include extra units and or manpower, and we could be requesting them from other departments such as Palominas, San Jose, or NACO. Once they get there, we'll task them with whatever we need, whether it's helping us to change out the air bottles, helping us to haul additional hose up and down, or possibly relieving our personnel that have already been working the fire for a long time. Because you go through two air pack bottles, which you've been fighting a fire for 40 minutes and all that gear, you're pretty well drained, and you do need to take a little bit of a break.
I had a question on the particular item you're talking about right now, and I refer back to the Moon Canyon fire when a lot of different agencies were involved.
Yes, sir.
In 2008, March of 2008. And I believe that's under the auspices of FEMA, I believe. So if either you or the chief would like to comment on that, I think the public would like to know how that's set up and how they respond to that. As I recall, I think 17 agencies came into the community to help with that particular fire.
That fire there, Mayor, was it turned into a wildland fire. It was a wildland fire. In turn, when we call for resources, which is either Arizona State Land Department or Forestry Service, it becomes a federal fire. And then you start calling your other resources, whether it be tank crews and incident commanders and or air attack. And that's why it becomes a federal fire. Because it's outside of your realm, outside of what you can provide to extinguish a fire, you need assistance. And that's why there are so many other agencies involved.
You guys did a great job.
I was just asking about the Mule Pass fire, because we had, I mean, if you saw the air show that was going on that day, that was actually pretty impressive. They had a couple of heavy tankers dropping, and the state actually took that fire over. Okay, back to the structure fires. Once we get everything, all the live flames are knocked down, we start a process which is called overhaul. An overhaul, that's where you'll see guys walking in with a whole bunch of tools, and we're kind of tearing into the walls a little bit, to the attic space, to make sure there's no fire that extended into any of those. We try to remove all the burnt items from the structure, such as the scorched or burnt furniture, mattresses, and also towards the end of overhaul right there, we'll assist PD in securing the structure, such as boarding up the windows and the doors to make sure nobody decides to go in there. And these people already had a bad enough day. They don't need to get their stuff stolen. During the cleanup phase of the fire, this would be the time where we start rolling up all of our hose that we used, gather up all of our tools, and we try to clean up any kind of mess we made. Once we get back to the station, that's where restock and reload come into play. When we get back to the station, we make sure all of our engines are full of fuel and all the booster tanks are full of water. We reload all the hose that we used with clean, dry hose. We clean up all of our tools and our air packs. We refill all the bottles that are there. We check for any broken equipment and repair or replace, if possible, anything that's damaged. This is done after every fire, no matter what time of day. So if the fire ends at midnight, you could still see these guys working out there at 3 o'clock in the morning getting their trucks back in order. Okay, next. Now we're going to touch a little bit on the wildland fires.
Mr. Halvin?
And when we're dispatched for wildland fires, if it's in the city limits in this area, the police department dispatches us. If it's outside, then the Arizona State Dispatch will actually call us on the phone and request us to respond to a fire wherever it's located. The equipment for that is, if it's in town, some of us have the brush gear that Nick's going to show you right now, which goes on over the top of our station uniforms, just like a set of turnouts. And if you're going out of town, you'll put on your green and yellows, which are the typical pants that you see on most of the wildland firefighters. And that just takes a little bit of time to do. And for those of us who don't have this particular setup right here, they'll actually respond in their turnouts, just because it's so much faster than trying to take your clothes off and put another set on. Because like Captain Castillo stressed, you get a brush fire in Old Bisbee, speed is of the essence on this. You have to get there quick, and you have to start attacking that fire as fast as you can. If the fire is not in city limits, we'll usually take we'll take one of our brush trucks, which is called a Type 6 engine. And that right there is your basic wildland gear. In town, we'll usually take both of our structure engines, and we'll also be taking one of our brush trucks with us. The pack that Nick has right there, every single one of us has one of those. We'll carry it on our backs on any wildland fires. And in the packs, we'll usually store water. And you can get an extended assignment where you're going to be up on the mountain all day, so usually take some food with you. Take as much water as you can comfortably carry, and hope that somebody else is going to be bringing you some more. In addition to that, the very bottom down there is his wildland shelter. Those are for if the fire gets out of control and it starts running at you, then that is your last ditch option right there to save your life. Yeah. Please don't open it, because those cost about $450 a piece. And we actually got those ones on a grant. Those are the new generation shelters right there.
Those are what you would cover yourself up
with?
Yes,
sir.
Okay.
We should have brought a plastic. Yeah.
And they look like little baked potatoes out there.
Unfortunately, some of them have become that.
Very so true.
What kind of temperatures can those withstand, you know?
I think those ones are rated for, what, five?
I think they're close to 1,000.
1,000?
It depends.
Okay, yeah, the older
on
ones.
The time and the temperature of the fire and how long you're exposed to.
Yeah.
So
those
would
ones were 500. These ones are up to 1,000.
So in that apparatus, you would try to cover yourself up in the terrain with dirt or whatever is necessary?
It depends on where you're at. If you're next to the truck, you don't get in the truck. You actually get on the leeward side of the truck, because the flame front will come and hit the truck, and you won't catch as much of the heat on the blast coming in. The truck is going to burn. So you might be able to take shelter in the truck for 2 minutes, and then you better get out, because the truck's going to be on fire.
I understand.
Yes.
Is there a shelf life on these?
If that thing starts turning, like you see all the silver coming off of it, then you have to take it out of service. The shelf life is basically just how good
until
a care you take.
Until it turns.
Yeah. Until it starts turning, until it starts discoloring, then you need to get a new one.
And how long can you shelter in them?
You stay, if you deploy your shelter and... If I'm with my crew, Captain Bernalite's in charge, then we don't come out of those shelters until he comes and tells us you can get out. Once you get in the shelter, you stay there until whoever your crew boss is or the team chief that day, whenever he decides it's okay, then you can get out of that shelter. Other than that, you stay there. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
Go ahead and get your shelter back together.
I'm just going to get it back.
Okay, the scene size up for wildland, it differs a little bit from your structure fires, because you also have to say the type of terrain, be it rolling hills, the flat area, or mountains. And the different types of slope, whether it's a gentle mountain, it's a steep mountain, you got cliffs hanging up right there, the type of vegetation you're going to be fighting a fire in, whether it's shrubs, grass, timber, chaparral, and are any structures threatened in the area? Because if the fire's moving quick, you have to basically look a mile down in front of you to see if there's anything there that's in the path of that flame front coming towards it. And then are there any utilities threatened? The majority of the utilities out there that would be threatened would be the high-voltage power poles or big natural gas lines, but the natural gas lines can extend some intense heat because they're very thick. Also, during your size up, that would be whenever you start requesting the additional resources in manpower, additional engines, aircraft, and a higher level of the Wildland Incident Commander. And Captain Delk on the Mule Pass fire. When we got there that day, he saw how the fire was going, and he was automatically on the phone to state land requesting all the air assets. Luckily for us, there was nothing else going on in the state that day. That's how come we ended up with two heavies and two seats. The seats are the little small engine planes. So on initial attack for wildland, if we can get our truck close enough, then we'll use the water. If not, if the fire's up on the side of the mountain, then you start out by using your hand tools, and you attack the fire best you can, which is basically you're scraping the ground to try to get all the brush away from it, so when the flame front hits it, it'll die down. Another way you could do it, too, is also a progressive hose lay, which you start a progressive hose lay with an inch and a half hose from the engine, and every 100 feet, we'll put a gated Y on it. After 200 feet, the hose drops down to a 1-inch hose with a gated Y every 100 feet, so you can attach other lines branching off, and you're able to fight more fire with just one engine. So, and it just keeps progressing on from there. That's why they call it progressive hose light. Initial attack on a wildland fire can last anywhere from 10 minutes to a few months, depending on the size of the incident. Mopping up on the wildland fires, that happens after the perimeter of the fire has been secured in the area that the crew's in, and they go in and extinguish any hot spots. On major fires, mop up will start while initial attack is still going on, and depending on the size of the incident, it'll last anywhere from a couple hours to a couple months. And the same with the restock and reload as we do with our structure engines. As soon as we get back into town, back at the station, first thing you do, fill it up with fuel. Check your booster tank, make sure that you have enough water in it. And luckily our tanks now, we also have foam on them, which actually helps tremendously when it comes to fighting a fire. And we make sure the foam's all topped off. We reload all of our hose that we used with clean and dry hose. Clean up all of our tools and check for any broken equipment and repair it or replace it if possible. And this is done after every fire, no matter what time of day it is. And that's my presentation. Do you have any more questions?
Just a quick comment. It's in incredible detail, and I guess the average person, including myself, would not be thinking about what's in the house. For example, ammunition, propane tanks that you mentioned, I would not have thought of those things. Of course, the electrical wires going in, the gas lines going in. That's serious stuff you have to deal with.
Yes, sir.
Maybe I didn't understand. How do you determine if there's ammunition or a propane tank?
We find it, hopefully, after we knock down the fire. Sometimes we find it when it starts blowing up and we get out of there.
So have you had incidences where, you know, ammunition has gone off?
Had oxygen tanks explode on us.
Okay.
But luckily, I haven't had any ammunition. George? Captain Castillo, Lieutenant Ray have. They've been doing this longer than me.
Thank you.
I have been on them whenever propane tanks have blown up, too, though.
How loud is that? And how dangerous is it?
That's real loud. That'll wake up the neighborhood.
Councilmember Sullivan?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could comment, with as physically demanding as it is with all the weight and equipment and you never know what you're going to come at, what kind of physical training do the guys have to go through in order to maintain their job or get hired or drug testing is required?
The drug testing, that would be on the chief. And we usually wouldn't. The guys that we hire, you can pretty much trust them. I mean, we look for people with good character. Every single person that's sitting out there, I trust them all of my life, every single one of them. And I know I don't have to worry about them with drugs because there's so many telltale signs about that. And we see that every single day. If someone was on drugs, we would know it right away. Comes to the physical training, we actually try to get in about 2 hours a day on cardio, weightlifting, and ever since the Douglas Hospital shut down, it's really hard to get that, so a lot of it falls on you on your off-duty time.
Let me find the drug testing. It's pre-employment. You're required to be drug tested before you're hired, so that's done before you're even considered for a position. If there's something for example, an accident or something like that, the city has a drug test policy. So if you crash a fire truck in the middle of the day, driving down the street, we're probably going to drug test as well.
Captain Perez made an interesting statement. He trusts his fellow people with his life, and that's quite a tribute.
Yeah, I do.
Amazing.
Every single person out there.
And it's true. Yeah.
Any other questions?
Any other questions or comments from the council? No, I don't think so.
Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Captain Perez.
Will be Captain Bernalek, correct?
EMS operations, again, 90% of what we actually do on a daily basis is medical nowadays. And with all the stuff that Lieutenant Perez just went through, we're thankful for that. The City of Bisbee Fire Department provides Advanced Life Support, or ALS for short, emergency medical services to the City of Bisbee and surrounding areas. Our area of medical coverage is designated by the state of Arizona through our Certificate of Necessity, and that's our CON, so we'll be calling it our CON. And our CON covers over 400 square miles. It includes the Naco Port of Entry, the Cochise County Jail, the Freeport McMoRan Mine, the Copper Queen Hospital, all the schools in the area. Our patient pool includes all the citizens of Bisbee, all our tourists and visitors, and all travelers along State Route 80, State Route 90, State Route 92 within our CON. And the boundaries of our CON are, of course, to the south, the Naco and the Mexican state line. To the west, we go off Highway 90 and Highway 92 to the San Pedro River. To the east, we go off Highway 80, almost to Cochise College in Douglas. We go to Paul Spur. And also to the west and the northwest, we go Highway 80 halfway to Tombstone. And then we cover out Double Adobe up to the Little Red Schoolhouse, and sometimes beyond, depending on what the staffing is with the smaller departments, Elfrida, Tombstone, whatever they might need. Our patients vary widely from newborns to the elderly, as do our reasons for emergency response. We go to cardiac emergencies, respiratory emergencies, diabetic, stroke, cancer, allergic reaction, chronic illness, pediatric emergencies, OBs, like we mentioned earlier, some of us have delivered babies, psychiatric emergencies, and all types of trauma, from car wrecks, industrial accidents, and your average accident at home, are some, but not all, the reasons that we get called. All of our paramedics and EMTs are state certified, and some of us are also nationally certified. The state of Arizona sets the level of care and the scope of practice that we can do. Nationally, the Department of Transportation covers all paramedicine and paramedics and EMTs. In addition, our paramedics must have certifications in advanced cardiac life support and pediatric life support. All Bisbee firefighters are CPR certified. All these certifications must be recertified every 2 years. And that requires that we complete refresher courses, continuing educations, and requirements and skill competency reviews that include advanced airway management. Our EMS program, although approved by the state of Arizona, is monitored and medically directed by Canyon Vista Community Hospital in Sierra Vista. That's our base hospital. And the base hospital provides us with a medical director, Dr. Everett Castle, under whose license we are able to practice our skills and level of care. The base hospital then provides a pre-hospital coordinator, and ours at this time is Battalion Chief Matt Romeyer from Sierra Vista Fire. And he sets the standard of care our department and other agencies in the county use. And he does this through standing orders, QI or quality insurance, and he continues the continuing education, the CEs. Through the base hospital, our department has received additional training that sets us apart from other departments. This training includes rapid sequence intubation, or RSI, and a quick explanation of that. All our paramedics are trained in advanced airway. Our RSI medic has specific extra drugs that will paralyze a patient who would normally not be able to be intubated to the point where we can then intubate that patient, take over his airway. And some of the occasions where that might be necessary are a motor vehicle accident where a patient receives a severe head injury but is still breathing and has a gag reflex. That's something that we have to take away. You can't put an endotracheal tube through a person's airway if they're still maintaining a gag reflex. So that's part of what the RSI program does. It allows us to control that airway. And you need an extra training and education for that. Along with the other advanced training that we have is in advanced IV drips. So we have higher level of medications that we can transport on our inner facilities so that we can do critical care of patients. Also, our department has IV certified our EMTs, and that's become very, very essential to our operation now that we're down to three paramedics. A lot of days, our department is running with only one paramedic actually scheduled and maybe one on call. So if there is a back-to-back call, where the paramedic may be on one call, and another emergency call breaks out, the EMT on that scene can start an IV and start getting the fluids available. In addition to running 911 emergencies, our department also takes interfacility transfers from the Copper Queen Hospital to hospitals with a higher level of service. A lot of times those are the Tucson hospitals. As with 911 calls, the level of care and the severity of the patient's condition may vary, but our department is capable of providing special care transports and critical care transports. Because of our increased training in the IV drip medications, we can provide this valuable and necessary service to our community. A lot of the transports, the interfacility transports do go to Tucson, as I mentioned. So when we do go to Tucson, we'll be going to UMC, TMC, UMC South, St. Joe's Hospital, St. Mary's Hospital, Northwest Hospital. These hospitals are all base hospitals. So when we're leaving our area, we contact that ER of the hospital that we're going to. Even though our patient may not be going to the ER, we're going to then be working under the medical direction of that hospital's emergency doctor. In that way, we're taking over patient care from the doctor and nurse at Copper Queen, and they're entrusting the care of that patient to a paramedic. So on the road for that 100-mile trip, we do have a safety net and protection with that medical control doctor. So if there's any change in patient status or we need any orders to push any medications, if it arises, we will be doing it under the direction of the receiving facility. So we're always in continuous contact that way.
Let me ask just to clarify that. So an EMT can take directions from the doctor at the hospital to administer drugs or whatever is necessary?
A paramedic, yeah.
Okay.
And then that's the difference. Paramedic is an ALS provider, an EMT is a BLS provider. And one of the main differences is the paramedics are the ones who utilize the drug box and are able to do pharmacology. EMTs have some medications that they can assist with, but basically the paramedics, that's part of our education, and we have almost 40 different drug classifications and drugs that we're responsible for in our drug box.
Let me ask this, since we're talking about paramedics to a certain degree. We have three. We have 7 days a week, three shifts. What happens? Do they work 7 days a week, 365 days a year? How are you handling
that? We have one per shift, if someone is on PTO or are off, then the two remaining have been covering for it. And it has increased our overtime budget significantly. But we, to keep our CON and to stay in compliance with the state, we need to be able to provide ALS coverage. So when we have contract with the state and we have to provide that service. So now we have two guys that just graduated, and that is awesome. So now we actually have five paramedics, and we have two more that just started the program. It's a year away. We hope to have those two graduate as well. We're real hopeful. And we are planning to possibly hire another position, and we would be asking for a paramedic at that time, or seeking to get a paramedic.
If my memory serves me correctly, it didn't seem like that long ago, 6, 7, 8 years ago. It seems like we had 8 or 9 paramedics. Is that generally, is that true? We had about that many at one time?
In my career, yeah, the most we've ever had is 12.
Okay.
And we have slowly and lost them to retirement or attrition, people gone on to other departments or other opportunities. But that's what I'm getting around to now.
Okay.
Is that we have 5 paramedics. We have 12 EMTs. We're committed to keeping and advancing our EMS program through education, skills, through scheduled monthly tape and charts. We do reviews, in-house exercises, and scenarios. And we do individual call and after-action plans. And we continue again with our advanced airway lab skills. And the point about the individual call after action plans is that we do, through our documentation, we have to record every call. And even though I might not be there personally for the calls, I review as the EMS coordinator. I do review all the reports. And usually the guys will come to me if there's an exceptional call or somebody was questioning about a call. And one thing we're very proud of is that we do not cover up or hide our mistakes. We learn from them. We feel that they're also a very good training tool. We're proud that we make very few, but in any operation, it's just something that can happen. And not necessarily a mistake, but sometimes we'll do a review and think of things that we could have done better, and we try to continue to improve that way.
I have one question for you. You said you have 5 paramedics. Is that with the IGA that you have the 5 paramedics?
No, that's going to be just after this graduation. That's going to be the staff.
So you'll have 5 paramedics.
Right. With okay. The good question, with the IGA, Palominas at one time did have 3 or 4 paramedics. They are down presently to 2, but they have been a big benefit in us increasing our interfacility transfers. So we have been able to use that. A paramedic from their area to take a transfer.
Okay.
We haven't really felt all that comfortable in allowing them to run 911 in the area just because they're not familiar with the area. And we're trying to, the new guys that just graduated, they're gonna go through a preceptorship, and the senior medics will be proctoring them and helping them along to be their safety net. And we're still doing that with the Palominas medics.
Thank you.
In 2014, our ALS scope of practice increased to include continuous airway pressure, or CPAP, and this allows us to better treat respiratory emergencies and pulmonary edema without using medication. It's actually a positive pressure mask that's put on you, and it puts pressure on when you on your respiratory part of your respiration, which keeps more oxygen in your lungs and helps expand the alveoli, and it helps remove fluid, and it's just it's something new to the EMS system, and we're proud to be a part of introducing that. One other upgrade we made is we have 1 cardiac monitor, which is an LP15, and this is similar to our other cardiac monitors, and the cardiac monitor reads the cardiac rhythm. The cardiac monitor is a diagnostic tool. It's also an electrical therapy tool. So on one side, you do the diagnostics. You get a 3 lead. You can see what the cardiac rhythm is. On the new monitor, it also has automatic blood pressure and pulse oximetry, so you can see what the O2 saturation is. On the other side is the therapy model, so you would have the quick connect pads. We no longer have paddles like in the old days to shock with. It's actually pads, so it's safer for everybody for hands-free. And there's three types of therapy you can do if you have a patient that's symptomatic with a low, with a slow heart rate. We can pace it up higher. If they're symptomatic with a very fast heart rate, 150 or greater, we can do what's called synchronized cardioversion, which shocks the heart and slows the rhythm down. And then, of course, if person, you'll see in the demonstration in a few minutes, if the person is having a heart attack and they need to be defibrillated, we can defibrillate with the cardiac monitor. So our LP15 is the newest one, and the one aspect of it that's higher than the others is it allows us to also monitor end-tidal CO2, or the amount of CO2 that is coming out of the patient. And that is just as important, we've learned, as oxygenation, and it is the new level and standard of care, and we're hoping to upgrade ourselves to get a couple of those, another one of those monitors in our fleet. We also give Mr. Johnson all the credit in the world for bringing us up to date on this one. Is we are now entering into electric documentation, and we have four tough books purchased, which are the computers that will be in the ambulance so that we can get away from doing handwritten paper reports. And this isn't just because it's modern technology that we're doing this. It is helpful. It does help keep the privacy of the patient's information a little more secure, but also for billing. Medicare and Medicaid, they already have a reduced reimbursement of our services. However, it would be even further reduced if we didn't participate in this program. So we are accommodating and updating that. So as far as staffing goes, looking into the future of our EMS program, the minimal optimal level of EMS for our department would be to have at least 9 paramedics with 12 EMTs and 5 ambulances. If we could do that, the size of the department would provide our citizens with the most complete and uninterrupted service available from the Bisbee Fire Department. This would take into consideration most of the difficult situations that can occur from time to time. With 3 paramedics per shift, we could easily cover back-to-back medical calls during structure fires, handle more interfacility transfers, and better provide for the health and safety of our citizens. This is our goal, to continually provide the best possible service with the highest quality of practice. That's what I got on units.
Any questions from the council?
Councilmember
Klein.
Not so much a question. I just find it very interesting that, as Captain Burnlight showed up on the slide up there, that Bisbee Fire is the only department in Cochise County that does both 911 and critical care interfacility transfers.
Yes, ma'am, and if I could go off script just a minute, I'd also like to point out that our firefighters and our EMS program, even though we're one of the smallest full-time paid departments in the county, we are, man-to-man, one of the hardest working. When these guys come to work with one paramedic on duty, that guy sometimes has to do 3 interfacilities in one day. So we're talking 600 miles of transport time. Up to 18 hours can be in the ambulance for that guy on that day. Also, with our EMS and fire system, we don't take it as a derogatory comment, but some people look at us as a stepping stone department. What we feel that is that we build a very good foundation for a firefighter and a paramedic, and these guys do go on to other departments. We try to hold on to them. We are trying to create a positive work environment here. To make up for some of the things that are out of our control. We can't pay them what we'd like to pay them. But these guys, I could plug any of these guys in Phoenix Fire, LA Fire, New York Fire. We have to wear a lot of hats. We have to do a lot of stuff. And these guys step up.
Councilmember Hansen.
What kind of certification is required for the paramedics and for the EMTs? And is that an annual certification? Is it a, and I know that there's also a national certification.
Okay, when the guys graduate from EMT school, which is a one semester class, they get nationally certified. And then that national certification allows them to become state certified. Then every 2 years you have to do a refresher course and become to keep your state certification, and through CEs you can keep your national certification, but you don't need to keep your national certification to keep your state. But most guys work so hard to get that they do. The two books that Raul just picked up, that's what the EMT course requires. Now the paramedic course, you have to already be an EMT. And then it's roughly a 16-month course. And the stack next to him there is what those guys have to go through. And of course, you're going to be upgraded in cardiology, pharmacology. It's a higher level of trauma, and just overall a higher level of care. Again, it's advanced life support. So that's also initially when you come out of school. These two guys were just nationally certified. They'll keep their national certification for 2 years. That automatically makes them state certified. And through CEs, refresher courses, they can. Every 2 years, we have to recertify each one. And then a paramedic has to have the advanced cardiac life support, the pediatric life support, every 2 years as well, as a minimum qualification for our base hospital.
And are all of the EMTs and paramedics nationally qualified at this point, or working on it?
Not everybody has kept their national registry, but okay. The majority of us have.
Okay.
Councilmember Sullivan.
How much does it cost to recertify every time, and do the firefighters have to pay for that themselves?
That's a great question. Also, we are real fortunate in our department. We have a real good relationship throughout the county with the helicopter companies, the hospitals, and the Cochise College. And an ACLS class can cost up to $150. A PALS class can be the same. And there are some research classes that are up to $200. Through our base hospital and our relationship with these other agencies that I mentioned, for the most part, we get it done for free. So we are real fortunate there. And we stay on top of it. The guys, we're all aware of each other's cert dates and times of expiration, and we try to do our best to make sure everybody doesn't get close to those dates.
Any other questions? No.
Next. I'll give a firefighter a moment. He's shy. Mayor, Council, I want to thank you guys for your time today. I know it's hard to take time out of your busy evening. Probably didn't know you're going to get held hostage by us tonight, huh? We're going to talk to you guys about community relations. This is the one time that we can interact with the public. When something's, catastrophe is not happening in their life, whether they're being sick or a fire, but everything's usually good when we're doing community relations. So we get to know them on a personal level. We're going to start out here with free blood pressure checks and glucose checks at the fire station. Most people don't realize you can just stop in at any fire station. We'll do your blood pressure, your glucose, a few other things too if need be. Sometimes it's somebody's not feeling well and they stop in. When we check their blood pressure, you probably need to be seen by your doctor. So it's kind of a preventative thing. Sometimes it gets to the point where we suggest that we transport them to the hospital after we check their blood pressure or glucose or even EKG or whatever it might be. The next one's my personal favorite is fire prevention in the school. This is typically a week-long event, and it starts out from preschool and goes to the fourth grade. During that time, we teach them the good old-fashioned stop, drop, and roll. We do, get out, stay out, have a meeting place, how to talk to firefighters when they show up. Little kids have a hard time seeing us in the gear that you guys see us, and that's frightening to them. So they actually get to see us put our gear on, and they realize that we're just another person under that, and they can come up and talk to us. And if there's a fire, and they could tell us crucial information. That's also a fun time because it seems like every kid in the school's house has been on fire a couple times. They all have great stories for us. We also do the standbys for athletic functions. I think Steve kind of touched on that a little bit. That's fun time. We get to talk to the public. We get to talk to parents. We get to talk to a lot of people, and we're there in case something happens. Public assist. Those are kind of a wide range of things. Anywhere from the, a fallen and can't get up, where we go help them up, get them in bed, get them back in their chairs. Oftentimes while we're there, we check, make sure that they don't need water, or we help them to the restroom. It also kind of lessens their chance of falling again if we help them while we're there. We'll feed their animals sometimes, water, whatever. We just really try to help them out if it's a public system, not an emergency type of situation. One of them that really kind of, that we did a few months back, was there was an elderly woman that was unable to climb the stairs to the rope or to go to a family event. And it was a very important family event. So we went and got her in the stair chair, took her up to the top. She was able to spend the evening with her family. And then we brought her back down and got her in the car. This is just in our heart to help our community. It's not all about fire or EMS. The next one is CPR, first aid certifications. That's kind of been touched on a little bit. Basically, our goal is to get more people out there that's trained in CPR. And we know that if there is a cardiac event, that the faster CPR is supplied, the greater chance that patient has of it. So, did you have a question now? You look like you did.
Well, yes, I always look like I have a question. Is there any charge for the CPR and the first aid?
Yes, ma'am, and it's supposed to be just a recruit for our cards that we give out in our books. $25 for the regular CPR class, and then $35 for healthcare provider. Then.
How do you advertise those?
It's kind of on a just word of mouth basis, yeah, mostly. It's pretty typical. Most fire departments provide that service. I think some of them are starting to kind of get away from it. It is kind of. It takes a person up for the, a couple hours. All right. So we also wear different color shirts, and you guys can see we're wearing orange. We look like pumpkins today. This is childhood cancer awareness, and leukemia was one of the reasons why there was a child in our community that was suffering from it. And we went and spent time with her and kind of let her know that we're wearing the shirts for her at that time. It is a broader span than just leukemia, but we also wear the pink. Pretty much we could wear a different color every month. So. The honor guard, and you see Mr. Mel Ray back there looking pretty sharp. He's going to come up and explain a few things about the honor guard.
I am Lieutenant Mel Ray, Mayor and Council. I've been with the department just over 20 years. I'm a paramedic, and I'm the commander of the Honor Guard. First, the service we provide to the community is we function in certain services, but they are not limited to only opening ceremonies, flag ceremonies, parades, funerals, etc. Recently, in conjunction with the City of Bisbee Police Department's Honor Guard, we did the opening flag ceremony for the Bisbee Douglas Club. We have also been invited by the Sierra Vista Fire Department's Honor Guard to participate in the 9/11 memorial services this Friday at 6 p.m. at the WSSR station in Sierra Vista. In addition to myself, our squad consists of 5 members, 8 chaplain, and 3 alternate members. To become a member of the Honor Guard, you must submit an application to the commander for consideration. Once accepted, the members must agree to purchasing their own dress uniform, which would be this, and to attend 2 mandatory training sessions per month. The Honor Guard functions without a budget. All our uniforms and equipment, with the exception of the ceremonial flags and stands, which were purchased by my good friend, Mr. Andy Heretic, and donated to the Honor Guard, have been purchased out of pocket by our members. Bisbee Fire is one of the few departments with an in-house Honor Guard made up of our own firefighters. We hope you can come and see us one of these days. Thank you.
Mayor and Council, my name is Ramon Devon. I been with the department going on 4 years. I'm also the Bisbee Firefighters Local 2146 Union President. The union is a separate entity from the fire department, but they go hand in hand. A few of the functions that we do is we do the annual Easter egg hunt that's all from these guys. They pay for it all. We do the annual Thanksgiving food drive, and that's when we're out begging by Safeway, getting whatever we can for the citizens that are in the city limits. We also do the Christmas food and toy drive, and again, we do the same thing. We raise the funding for the 4th of July fireworks show. We provide a lot of the funding to certain events. We sponsor Little League teams. We help kids go to foreign travels or whatever by providing funding for that. We also, for the last two, three years, we've assisted with the back-to-school supply drive that's been going on in Bisbee. And we assisted with the first Movies in the Park that Mr. Johnson has created, and it's been a positive. So that's what we do, and amongst other things, that's just kind of the highlights of what it is that we do.
We certainly appreciate that, Mr. Bobone. It's more than just a fire department. It's a part of our community. It's part of the heart and soul of our community, and I want to thank all of you for being a part of that. Any other questions or comments from the council? Didn't mean to interrupt. I just had to say that.
That's my spiel.
There's a few future endeavors that we would like to include into our PR eventually. We would like to do blood pressure and glucose checks outside the station, whether it be Safeway. It would probably be the best bet for us because we can catch people from all over the community. Cardiac Awareness Day would be something that we could do, possibly out of Safeway. Just giving out pamphlets on how to take care of yourself, basically, what to notice signs of a cardiac event. The same with the Stroke Awareness Day. That would be something important because you could also know the signs of a stroke, how long you have to get to a hospital where they can give you the medicine, TPA, to actually be effective. Immunizations for city busy employees. There's a few paramedics that are certified to give immunizations. That'd be a good one because you don't have to go to the doctor. You can come here at a certain day and get your immunizations. Firefighter Explorer Program. That's something we did have in the past. It's something that we really would like to bring back. It allows high school kids to kind of explore the option of becoming a firefighter. Typically meet once a month. They can get scholarships through that program. It's a it's actually a Boy Scout ran and insured program. And it's really, the possibilities are endless for that one. A youth summer camp, that was another one that we used to do. It was just a summer camp for different age groups to spend a week with us, off-duty firefighters basically. And we would run through water safety, how we extricate people out of the vehicle, and just a lot of different things. Run through our smokehouse. We have a smokehouse that simulates a house that's on fire. And they learn to crawl through the smoke safely and get low, and how to fill the doors and make sure that it's a safe door to open. That was a camp that we ran approximately 4 or 5 years ago. It was a success during the time. Just kind of takes quite a bit of staffing to run. Home paramedic program is kind of a new system that's being kind of moved to the fire department. And basically what it is we would be responsible to go to people's homes. If they were discharged from the ER the night before, we would make sure that they're taking their medicines properly. We would assist them with hanging any IV drips, make sure they're home safe. It's pretty new to the fire service, but possibly somewhere down the road we could implement that into a service that we provide to our community. And that's all I have. Thank you guys, and have a good evening.
Thank you, Mr. Davies.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. My name is Clarence Hickman. I've been with the department 4 years and 9 months now. I was going to talk to you all about the fire inspection program. As Lieutenant Perez stated earlier, all of our fire inspectors did take the inspector course, and that's how we all obtained our certification. It it was done by the state fire marshal's office and also proctored by them. So I'll go ahead and get into it. So the fire inspections are the single most important non-emergency activity performed by the fire department. This is a critical examination of the workplace, which helps us to create strategic and tactical plans of action to identify and record any kind of hazards and then take any type of corrective action on those hazards if needed. So the inspection program, it's used to perform business inspections to minimize the risk of life and property loss from fire, as well as educating the business owners in fire prevention. This also helps firefighters understand the building construction, also helps us to identify hydrant and utility shutoff locations, of course, which is vital in an emergency situation. When we do that, we want to also get a drawing of the floor plan of the business. It helps us to create a diagram and divide the workplace into areas based on the process that is being used to conduct whatever type of business that they do at that location. It also helps us to visualize the activities that go on in the workplace and identify, you know, different stuff in the business, aisles, stairways, air ducts, fire exits, personnel, where they're working, and different types of machinery, equipment, and materials. This helps the firefighters, if there is a fire at that location, we know the layout of the building, and we can identify and know where any type of hazardous materials or hazardous condition may be. So the fire prevention and pre-incident planning, it helps us to identify, you know, any types of hazards, such as in the 1908 fire, you know, that was such a devastating situation. But by us doing our pre-incident planning and then educating the business owners, that working hand-in-hand with each other helps us to be able to work under those extreme conditions. So fire inspections are performed on all new businesses and any business that has changed ownership or name. The inspections are done annually when possible, or if any hazardous condition is brought to our attention by the public, then we initiate an inspection at that location. So the Bisbee Fire Department currently has three fire inspectors and fire marshal. Myself, fire inspector, also fire inspector Captain Davey, and fire inspector Lieutenant Ray, and then fire marshal Jim Richardson. So we all conduct fire inspections. So since fire inspection and fire prevention programs have been implemented, studies have shown a dramatic drop in residential and commercial fires, which also include fire-related fatalities. So here's some numbers. In 2014, we did about 80 building fire inspections. And this year, we're currently at 56. So we're kind of right in line to reach that same number this year. So that's pretty much it. We also do courtesy residential safety fire inspections, if anyone needs to have those done. We do those for free. They just need to call us at the station, and we'll come out and check out the residents.
Is new housing construction, is that mandatory that a new house has a fire inspection? Is that part of the contractors?
It goes through a building inspection, okay. Which we also can go out there, and we work hand-in-hand with the building inspector here with the city.
Okay. Any other questions from the council? Mr. Hickman, thank you.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. My name is Jim Richardson, and I am the lieutenant in charge of vehicle maintenance, and I'm also the fire marshal. I've been with the department for 14 years. I'm just going to start off and give a basic inventory of the vehicles that we have and use and their purpose and their current mileages, if you care to know that. Up on the screen, our first engine up there is our frontline engine 81. It's stationed at Station 81 on Highway 92. That's our newest engine. That's a 2004 GMC structural firefighting engine. The current miles on this is 30,000 miles. The second one, the white one on top, is engine 82. That's a 1991 International Structural Firefighting Engine. This engine is also a frontline firefighting truck, and it's stationed at Station 82 up in Old Bisbee. The current miles on it is 90,000 miles. And the bottom one is engine 811. It's a 1981 GMC structural firefighting engine. This engine is a backup engine to our frontline firefighting trucks. We usually use it mainly if one of the other ones has to go in for maintenance or...
Excuse me just a second, Mr. Richardson. Yes. Did you say 1981?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, that's almost as old as my car.
It still runs and performs pretty well for its age. It's tired. But it gets us out of a jam. And next we have Brush 81. This is a 2004 GMC 3500. It's a Duramax diesel, 4x4. This is a Type 6 brush truck. We use this vehicle on brush fires. It used to go out of state quite a bit, but due to the loss in personnel, our engine bosses and stuff moving on, we haven't really been able to send it out of town or out of state. The next truck, Squad 81, that's our newest brush truck. That's a 2012 Dodge Ram, 4x4 Type 6 brush truck as well. It's also considered a quick attack. It can also be used as a rescue truck. This vehicle is the one that Mr. Timby purchased us, if you're not aware of that. We can't thank that guy enough. Rescue 81, that's a 2004 Duramax diesel 4x4. This rescue truck, it goes on every call. It carries our jaws of life, generators, extra tools that we use on vehicle accidents, on structure fires. It's a multi-purpose truck. And the miles on that right now are just about 170,000 miles. I forgot to tell you the miles on Squad. It's only had one oil change. It's got 3,200 miles on it. And it's 3 years old. And the brush truck, Brush 81, the miles on that are 30,000 miles. Tender 81, that's a 1993. We don't have a picture of that. It's mainly a public works water truck. We borrow it during the wild land season. It helps replenish the brush trucks when they go out on wildland fires or any situation that we might need extra water in. But it doesn't stay at our station. It stays down at the public works yard. The ambulances, Medic 81, that's our newest ambulance. It's a 2010 GMC Duramax diesel. It's an ALS ambulance. It's our frontline unit stationed at Station 81. The current miles on it is 81,000 miles. Medic 811, it's a 2007 Ford E350 wheeled coach ALS ambulance. This is primarily our interfacility ambulance, the one we take to Tucson mostly. And it's also a backup 911 ambulance for our city. Current miles on it is 314,000 miles. This unit's on its third motor and I believe second transmission. Medic 82 is the frontline unit out of Station 82 up in Old Bisbee. It's a 2005 E350 ALS ambulance. Current miles on it is 316,000. This unit, I believe, is on its second motor and possibly second transmission. Medic 821, the bottom blue and white ambulance. It's Medic 821 is a 1999 Ford wheeled coach ALS ambulance. This ambulance is the backup to Medic 82. It's stationed up at Station 82 as well. Current miles on it is 273,000. This one has been our workhorse. We've had to do the least amount of maintenance on this one. It's brought us through a lot of tough times. It's not the prettiest thing, and it's pretty beat up, but it keeps on running. So. Their support vehicles, Support 81 is a 2004 GMC 3/4 ton. This vehicle is used as a backup rescue truck, or it's a on-call vehicle for the guys that are on call, so they can have lights and sirens going to emergency call if need be. It's also used as for work-related jobs or activities. And Support 811 is basically the same. It's just a backup to that. It's another on-call vehicle. Those units, the first one has 130,000. Support 811 has 153. Chief 8 is our Chief Ernest 2003 Chevrolet Trailblazer. That's his chief's vehicle. Self-explanatory, I think. 69,000 miles right now. And we also, Palominas, we utilize Palominas' two ambulances, and it's their medic unit is Medic 191. We don't have any pictures of those. And Medic 1911. Those are around 40,000 miles. We utilize those on interfacility transfers. We also have a parade vehicle. It's our 1941. I believe you guys saw a picture of that earlier. And thanks to FEMA and the Assistance to Firefighter Grant, we were awarded monies to purchase a new ambulance and a new fire truck. We're super happy about that.
Any questions from the council?
I have one question.
Councilmember Sullivan.
With the Bush 81, you mentioned that you used to take it out of state more. I was just curious, is that just to assist with wildlife fires or something?
Yeah, just like the fires over in California or anywhere out of state that they need extra help, the state will call down and see who's available. Because their wildland season is usually after our wildland season. Our monsoon comes in and washes ours out, so we're pretty much free. And their wildland season is later than ours, so it used to give us opportunity to go out of state and make extra money for the city when we had engine bosses and we had more personnel to backfill, stuff like that. We don't really have the personnel to do that right now, but it was a money maker for us. I don't ever think we made a lot of money, but it was something extra. And, you know, hopefully in the future we'll be able to get back into that. I know a lot of the guys enjoy the wildland fires.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from the council? Nope.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Mr. Richardson. Thank you. To the audience listening, we are waiting for the paramedics and EMT to set up a demonstration for us. So far, it's been a magnificent presentation. I'm highly impressed. Dead Air normally loses viewers, and I want to keep them here because it's been so informative and just an outstanding presentation. I see you put a lot of time and effort into this, and the public is, those that are listening or watching, I'm sure, are very appreciative of it.
We will now present to you a simulation of a sudden cardiac arrest. Imagine, if you will, your loved one collapses in front of you. After calling 911, you anxiously await EMS to arrive. EMS assignment, man down, 118 Arizona Street.
With that, medic, 81-81, responding to you.
Copy, medic 81 responding.
Bisbee Medic 81, Rescue 81 on scene.
Bisbee copies, Medic 81, Rescue 81 will be on scene.
Sir, are you doing okay? We got a code blue. Go ahead, call code blue. Go ahead and start compression.
Bisbee Medic 81, we
code blue is our sign to all other units and personnel that the patient is confirmed as pulseless and not breathing. Following this in, we'll begin a series of events to provide the best possible outcome. Now the team leader will start making assignments, and he directs his men to the treatment of this patient. they're doing now is initiating continuous compressions, respirations. They're inserting an OPA, hooking up the cardiac monitor, and starting oxygen via non-rebreather.
Energy medicating two,
engineering
two
in
round, medicating one's
location. Copy. Medicating two, engineering two responding. Once they have the monitor hooked up, rapid EKG interpretation becomes crucial to the treatment of this patient. This will make the determination of shock, not too shock, placement of external pacemakers, and which course of drugs would be the most beneficial. But first and foremost, reestablishment of oxygenated blood flow to the brain and heart. Once blood flow has been reestablished, the patient will be rapidly packaged for transport. The use of the rigid backboard assists in giving a hard surface in which to perform proper compressions. It also helps in moving the patient from the floor or room to the gurney. Once on the gurney, the patient will be moved into the medic unit.
Medic 82, Engine 82 on scene.
As the additional personnel arrive, the team leader will assign them to tasks as needed. The arrival of an additional paramedic will greatly offer the ability to perform advanced life support actions. The size of the patient compartment in the ambulance is very limited, and space will be an asset.
Let me know when it's 2 minutes for another body check. Yeah.
2 minutes.
And can you go ahead? All right, go ahead and stop. Okay, continue. It looks like we're in the beginning, guys. Go ahead and take the person. I need my airway roll.
What is happening now is they are delivering sharks to a heart that is receiving multiple electrical impulses, but not in the order they should be in. Once you shock the heart, you reset the electrical impulses so that they flow directly to the areas they should.
Let me know when to get that first down in. 2 minutes. Three jumps out. Make sure you guys are listening. Yeah, I don't know my job, but I need to be here. I don't know. Okay. Ready? 1, 2, 3.
Intubation is the placement of a tube into the patient's trachea to maintain an adequate airway. Once the tube is in place, the intubation must be verified as having correct placement by four different methods. First, during the insertion, the paramedic must visualize the tube as it passes through the vocal cords.
Go ahead. I need you guys to listen at the guys who sound
aware. The first round is at the end, 1976.
Ears.
Second, lung sounds should be checked over the abdomen and anterior chest, which would be the front. If you are in the stomach, you will be hearing gurgling sounds rather than breath sounds. And you want to hear breath sounds on both sides of the chest. Third, The presence of condensation in the ET tube indicates placement in the trachea. And fourth, the use of an entitled CO2 monitor confirms gas exchange if the ET tube is properly placed. This gold standard capability is not available on this monitor.
2 minutes.
EMS assignment. 40-year-old male. Nausea. 1, 2, 3, 4 Nowhere Avenue.
Yeah, but we got to take out that gear in the front. The last one was given 2 minutes ago.
We got what time you got?
It is now 1959.
Medic 82.
Medic 82.
Medic 82, break them out. Going to 1, 2, 3, 4 Nowhere.
All right, we're all set. We got our
copy. Medic 82 responding. This happens often, receiving a call in the middle of an ongoing emergency. It requires us to pull resources from one to send to the other. This reduction of staffing can gravely reduce the outcome of both. High quality CPR is fatiguing. Frequent rotation of personnel ensures continuous and proper CPR. A tired compressor cannot maintain the constant rate and depth as is necessary for adequate perfusion of the cells.
I got the call.
Transport to the emergency department must be done in a way to ensure rapid delivery and safety of personnel in the patient compartment and the public. It takes a great deal of training to be able to drive emergent traffic and be smooth enough for the providers to perform their duties. Copy. Medic 81 arrives Copper Queen. Bisbee Fire Department EMS providers train constantly to give the citizens the best service we can to ensure the greatest possible outcome for those you love and care for. Once delivery of the patient is made at the Copper Queen Emergency Department, the crew will immediately set about cleaning and restocking their bags and medic unit so that they may be ready to answer your next call. Thank you very much.
Just a couple of questions or comments. Yes, sir. It is apparent to me that this fire department, top-of-the-line professionals, there's no doubt about that.
Thank you, sir.
At all. But what you go through must be incredibly stressful, but you're trained for that. But it nevertheless must be a lot of stress, especially when you're on a call and you're getting another call. The other thing is I was kind of wondering how this works, which you didn't have this tonight, the emotional trauma that you have to experience with loved ones, wives, children, or whoever that might be. You have any comments on how you deal with that? I know each situation is probably unique and different, but that has to be pretty intense.
Every one of us has developed our own unique and personal ways to deal with the stress.
Yeah, okay.
The room in our ambulance is not all that great, especially if we try to...
You want to go over to the microphone so our audience can hear it that's out there somewhere?
I was just saying, as you can see, as you have a lot of people moving around, doing different things, doing multiple tasks. You, on the code with our staff, you're not going to be stuck doing one thing. You're going to need to be able to just move from position to position to position and know your job. That being said, we have a lot of movement, and fortunately we have a couple rigs that we're able to go on both sides of that gurney
in a van ambulance to be able to do all that movement. That's not going to happen. So that's and we have minimal space as it is with what we have there. So we have to do all that in that limited space with all the extra people in there. So just to kind of give you like a little bit of a visualization of what is that.
I understand, Mr. Villasenor, that you're just about ready to become a paramedic, or maybe you already have.
Yes, today I got my certificate.
Congratulations.
Along with Nick, he also got his
certificate. I'm very proud of you guys. Any other questions or comments from the council? Councilmember Dowdy.
How do you handle the families when you're trying to work on the patient? Do they get in your way?
A lot of times, no, they don't, and they're scared, understandably. We try to keep their feelings and them in mind as well, and at times we have to break somebody off to treat them as well. They hyperventilate, they faint. Anything could happen. We could have multiple patients at any time. And the guys are trained to do that and be, even in the most chaotic situation, their compassion comes through and helps everybody out.
One more comment. Chief Ernest, your fire department is top of the line, and you were the guy at the head of it. I offer my sincere appreciation for your 38 years of service to this community. Remarkable. You have a great organization that you have created and helped assist. Councilmember Klein.
Just to add to Ms. Dowdy's talking about some of the families, and it is very traumatic for the families that are there, but some of these guys will carry, you know, little stickers in their pockets or something like that so they can, you know, kind of deal with the younger kids and try and get them a little distracted, and you don't have that in a big city.
Captain Bornelight.
Well, we thank you for your time. We've asked you to ingest and digest a lot of information, and we hope that, as you've all seen, that our members of our department have to wear many hats. They have to be able to transition into different roles, tasks, and responsibilities. And we face challenges under hazardous, chaotic, and stressful conditions. But we all believe you can't always control the situation you find yourself in, but you can't control the way you react to it. And we appreciate you and the respect you've shown us tonight. And we do commend Chief Ernest for building a great department. We hope we've shown you enough that we deserve all your support to continue to keep our department funded for now and the future, to help us keep our high standards and above else, that we do it in a way that assures that all our firefighters go home after every shift. Again, I thank all the guys. And please come out and see us at Bisbee 101 on September 17th, and we can go into any of this in more detail. There's so much more, but we just appreciate what you've been
on behalf of the community. I want to extend my appreciation and thanks for an incredible organization and a lot of incredible human beings that are working in that organization. I'm very proud of you all, and I think I speak on behalf of the entire community. Thank you. Captain Perez.
We would also, Lieutenant.
Oops, sorry.
We would also like to thank the Bisbee Mining and Historic Museum for all the help that they've given us over the years for any kind of presentation that we've ever done. And we just wanted to make a special shout out for that. Thank you.
Thank you. We do have a couple of people signed up. Former council member Budge. Okay.
This is a great night. I just wanted to follow up on a couple little things. As somebody that went to paramedic school in 1976, I covered 400 square miles myself, two paramedics. The other side of the valley was 400 square miles. So I start feeling like these guys, I have a certain synergy. One thing I didn't think they pointed out, and I wanted to point out how important it is, because when I started in my career and I was the paramedic, we worked with 11 incorporated towns, and most of those had volunteer and part-time paid individuals. We were the only full-time fire department in that area. That's why we had the paramedics. Many times we would beat them there, even though I'd have a 20-minute response time to some of my areas. So what's so important here to remember is time is time is time, time, time. We just can't get away from the idea of what it takes with a full-time department with time. A fire will double in size every 2 minutes until it really gets going. Then it will double in size every 30 seconds. So you think your house is half on fire in 30 seconds, the whole thing, as soon as it flashes over, will be. For medical, you have 6 minutes without blood going to the brain, and the brain starts to die. So keep those ideas in mind, and when you start trying to bring people from home or somewhere else to start taking care of you, that they're not there and ready to roll, I've just seen it's a disaster, and it's just not a professional system like we have. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Former council member Ken Budge. Former council member Benny Scott.
I'm the last one, and I get the horror of the last. You know, I've been in this town for all my life. Worked with the fire department for 27 years. I was the first fire investigator that they had with the Bisbee Police Department. These guys have come a long ways. These guys are the guys that bring our businesses to town. People move away if we don't have a good emergency service, if we don't have a good fire department, a good police department, a good EMT service. They're gone. Now then, and I'll put it right to you folks, you're old enough to ride in a red bus. I've been in it twice. My wife's been in it once. Do you know what it means when you're riding in that thing and you're talking to a guy that called you by the first name and you know him? Do you know what confidence you have in yourself? You know you're going to make it. That gentleman right there, you don't know how much I love him. He made me feel like I was going to live. Now then, I'm going to give a little kudos to these guys. Been in this little situation twice. The other day at the Queen Mine, we had an incident. Second time I've been there and a man goes down. I was standing outside of the mine. Doug got a hold of me and he says, Benny, get the motor out, get three cars hooked up. We got the ambulance coming. We have a man down at the 1500. By the time I got a motor out, got three cars hooked up, these guys flowed out of that ambulance like they were being poured out of the water out of a boot. We bloated them on them three cars, threw three hats on them, put some lights around their neck. And this, I'm going to say this call, and I'm not going to check your log, had to come right after 1 o'clock, right at about 1 o'clock, maybe 2 or 3 minutes after 1. As we started with that train, Doug went through, I opened the doors. These guys were on that train. He went in, turned that train around, dumped, let them off, turned that train around, came back out. I brought the other train out, went back in with that train, and at 2 o'clock, and at 1:30, I was getting ready to load another train. These guys went in, went out, did their job, and I don't know what was wrong with the guy. Maybe diabetic, or had a problem, or something. This is the second one I've done. But you don't understand. I mean, people need to understand. I can't say their response time was more than 5 minutes. It couldn't have been. Because I know how long it took me to get that motor out of that shed and hook them three cars up, and they were standing there. These guys deserve a good hand, folks. And if you lose them, you'll never get them back.
Thank you, former Councilmember Benny Scott. Any other comments from the council? Councilmember Klein.
I, too, wish to thank Chief Ernest and all of his men for coming out and doing this. There's a lot of history in this department. The fact that we are the oldest paid professional department in the state speaks volumes. And only one on-duty death in 1909. That proves to me that these guys are very well trained. They have each other's backs as well as us, the citizens. And Tucson Fire would like to claim that they hired the first professional female. They didn't. It was us, and I do remember when that happened. And Leslie wasn't here too long, but we still have that. So that's another, you know, another part of our history that a lot of people don't know. And I don't know. I've got notes everywhere, but you know, we can just see what they do, how much they do. And again, I have to say, it is no secret that I appreciate, value, and respect our fire personnel and all that they do for this community. And I completely trust every one of them with my life and that of my family's lives. And I don't take that lightly. And I feel that public safety, police, and fire are the most important services that any town or city can provide and owes their citizens. And, you know, you guys always know that I will continue to support you and fight for you. Thank you for everything.
Any other comments? Council Member Dowdy.
I have a little funny thing, kind of, that years ago I had occasion to have the guys come to my house and pick me up, and they literally picked me up. And today I was looking at all of that equipment. I could never become a firefighter because that equipment weighs more than I do. Anyhow, I had a puppy at that time, a little tiny puppy, and before they ever put me on the stretcher to take me out, they made sure the puppy was in her kennel. They secured my back door. They took the keys out of my purse and took me out on the stretcher and locked my front door. Where in the world do you get service like that? They very carefully put me in the ambulance and took me to the hospital. I don't know of any city in the United States where you would get service like that. I thank you guys. I have said many, many times that you are the best in the state of Arizona, probably in more states than Arizona. Thank you so much for doing what you do. You always go the extra mile. Thank you.
Any other comments from the council? Finally, let me thank Councilmember Klein for asking for this work session. Well done. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
I'll second that. We have a motion and a second to adjourn. All those in favor indicate by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion passes unanimously. This meeting is adjourned.